It's going.
Well, why don't you start out what you were listing things that were, you know, ammunition and things flying overhead and everything, or whatever it was, in Miami Beach, and that's what got me started on this. And just get that down.
In Miami, they had overhead at all times, as I recall, Huey gunships, helicopter gunships with rocket pods, and just like the ones in Nam, and Loach helicopters, which are light observation helicopters, which are also used in a combat role in Vietnam. I assume they were part of the National Guard. In fact, well, there was even more than the National Guard down there, but since it was a presidential thing, they had some army unit down there, but they never went into the streets, so I don't know. I don't know who they were.
What exactly are rocket pods?
Rocket pods, you see pictures of the helicopters. Rocket pods are those big, looks like barrels they put on the outside of the helicopter. They attach them to the struts. And a pod holds a number of rockets. I can't remember how many, but a shipload of rockets.
And they can be fired from inside?
Yes, they're fired from the pilot's control or the co-pilot. There's a firing panel, if I remember correctly.
And they wouldn't be put on for anything other than...
They have only one purpose, and that's to discharge rockets.
That's what I mean. Well, that's certainly not going to make any vets feel comfortable. Sometimes I'm glad I make them.
Sometimes, oh. That made us nervous because we knew they weren't there to help us. We didn't know how far the government was willing to go. But the presence of helicopter gunships didn't make us any more confident or any less apprehensive about the limits which they might go to stifle dissent and criticism.
Did you want to say anything about that cop you saw the night before?
It was Lynn Witt. Lynn was a disabled Marine, Lance Corporal. And he was disabled at Khe Sanh during Tet. And he has a brace clear up to his hip on his right leg, if I remember correctly. And Lynn and I were standing in front of the convention center. Both of us had our ribbons on, and we both had over three rows of ribbons, a minimum of three rows. And both of us were obviously disabled veterans. And we were tried to strike up a conversation with a police officer that was, he wasn't state police, I think he was some sort of a county officer from Florida who was part of the convention security. And he was holding a riot baton, the big ones that are about 3.5 feet long, look like ball bats. And we were trying to talk to him, ask him, you know, we were just trying to be cordial with him because we don't want to give people in uniform shit since we've been worn uniforms before and got a lot of shit for it. And he spit on the ground in front of us and looked at us and said, "Tomorrow night." And this was the night, this was the next to the last night of the convention. And later on, we realized that they were going to let him out of their cage on Wednesday night because they kept all those people pretty much bottled up.
Sure had enough of them.
Sure. Just look at the man they were protecting. They need him.
Well, one reason I like that story is it's a nice contrast to DC-3. Just what a little over a year could do.
Yeah. Well, maybe if DC-3 would have been held in the South, responses would have been a little different, too. About it, 75 to 80% of the Washington, D.C. police forces, Vietnam veterans, was. They were offering, if you would join the Washington, D.C. police or the New York City Police Department, you could get 6 months off your time in the service. They were offering early outs to all physically qualified Marines, at least. Mm-hmm. And we ran into, on DC-3, I ran into a whole lot of cops that had been in Nam, same time I was. Guys that had been in 9th Marines. We had them bring us, in fact, they brought me milk, and coffee, and donuts one morning. A couple of them just got off duty. We also had that happen in Topeka, Kansas, in Kansas City, Missouri, where individual police officers would go out and buy us. Usually they were Vietnam veterans, but a couple of times they were World War II veterans. The thing that I used to get a lot was guys would come up to me and they'd look at my ribbons and they'd say, well, anybody with three purple hearts, you know, I ain't going to give you any shit. Here it goes. So it was always fine. I got away with perhaps more than others. And I usually wore my ribbons. Precisely for that reason. Because my appearance certainly wasn't conducive to a positive response for most people.
Looked like a hippie.
Sure. But in wearing a jungle jacket, and then the ribbons denoting my service record. That was the bridge that a lot of people needed, because they were raised to really respect the decorations. And it's hard for them to condemn someone when they're also idolizing the decorations. And because if they gave me shit, they had to give a decorated individual ship, you know, and the decorations, the medals, they call them medals. And the medals were very important. My life was threatened because of my medals.
What?
Dewey Canyon 3. A guy from United Press International saw me coming, and I had a note attached to my decorations. And I had this little thing to say, you know, we walked up to the microphone, we said our pit if we wanted to say anything, and we threw the decorations over the fence that they erected to keep us off the steps of our own fucking capital.
I remember.
And turns out that they taped it and they filmed it. So my parents, who had no idea I was in the anti-war movement, found out because they saw me on television in Colorado Springs. And later on the way home, they heard it on the radio. They listened to me saying these things that they thought were a little bit out of character because I just didn't talk about the war with them. And when I got home, when they got home, the front page of our local newspaper, which I had been their first living hero, the first one to be decorated and come home alive, and I'd made front page coverage when I came home and was always a guest of honor at all these places, you know, church gatherings and schools and all this. Well, this time the headline was, I remember the first headline was Wounded GI Tells of Ambush. And they had a picture of me being decorated by General Hockmuth, who was commanding general of the 3rd Marine Division, and General Tru Vong, who was the commanding general of the 11th Vietnamese Division, because I was receiving a decoration from the Vietnamese also. And they had a picture of me laying in my bed getting decorated, they were pinning the shit on my pillows, and me just covered with bandages when I was shot.
Oh, that was the bad one.
And, this time it said local vet a protester, and they listed most of my decorations. They didn't list them all, but they also listed verbatim what I had on the note and exactly what I said. And it was front page. And by the time I got back from D.C., I stopped in to see my folks to let them know what I'd been up to. People had been calling me, threatening my life because I had thrown away their medals.
Their medals.
Fucking right. And that's what kept my father from getting angry with me, because he'd always told me if I ever did anything like that, I could burn my birth certificate. But by the time I got home, somebody else had done give me some shit, right? And As far as my father's concerned, you don't fuck with the family, because the family fucks back. And he was really angry that they'd say that about the medals that, you know, I had earned. And he said, those motherfuckers didn't do nothing for him. He says, if they want to give you any shit, they'll take us both back to back. And then my big brother wanted in on it, and my cousin, you know, all the Musgraves in the area wanted in on it.
Far out. What did your note say?
Said to the American people, the silent and ungrateful, I am returning crippled chest and left arm and bad leg, left leg. And then I, along with, and I listed the decorations. And then I signed my name, service number, rank, branch of the service, when I was in Nam, who I was with in Nam. And then I made my little... I didn't know what I was going to say until I got up to the microphone. It just kind of fell out.
What'd you say?
I just looked at the crowd, and then I pointed back at the Capitol building, and I said... I held up my shit. And I was going to say something about it, and then I just said... The main thing I wish I could return are the lives I took in their name. In the Capitol. And then I couldn't say anything else. Turned around and threw my shit over the fence and walked away.
I'm glad you couldn't say any more. Because I think you said it better.
Yeah.
Sure was a heavy day.
I thought it was going to end. I thought it was all going to end. But it didn't. Another one of those times made me wish I was back in the bush.
What?
Life was a whole lot cleaner and a lot simpler in the bush. There wasn't any philosophies to try to figure out. There wasn't any policies to deal with. It was just staying alive and watching out for your buddy. Your buddy watching out for you. And thinking about things like getting home, a letter, chow, when you get to clean up, clean clothes, dry clothes, not getting killed. I miss for a lot of reasons. And on the thing that you wrote in your manuscript, I'll just go through a whole, my little basic history here.
Oh, fine. Yeah, yeah, that'll be much better than me trying to pull it back out of air.
I enlisted in the Marine Corps when I was 17 years old, in the beginning of 1966. And when I got in, I volunteered for infantry and volunteered for Vietnam, but I was too young. You had to be 18 to go to Vietnam. So as soon as I turned 18, I put in my AA form to go to Nam. My MOS was 0311-0331, which is, you know what MOS is?
I know what MOS is, but I don't know what the numbers are.
Okay, 0311 is rifleman. 0331 is machine gun. I went to Nam in January of 67 and was attached to Delta Company, 1st Battalion of the 9th Marine Regiment, 3rd Marine Division. Served 67-68, 11 months and 17 days in the bush. I was permanently disabled by my third wound. After 17 months in naval hospitals, I was honorably retired from the Marine Corps as a corporal. I got my nickname Gunny from, there's a rank in the Marine Corps called Gunnery Sergeant. It takes you 10 to 12 years to make it. It's E7, pay grade E7. You gotta be a lifer to get there. You gotta stay in that long. And people call me Denny because of my attitude. I had a lifer attitude. I loved the Marine Corps. I still do. Never stop. The whole time I was in the movement, I loved the Marine Corps. Never dropped shit on it because it didn't start the war. I hate the government. because they started it, and they lied to me to keep it going. They lied to me to get me to do their killing. While they protected their own sons to keep their sons from going. I hate the government because they're the ones that made sure I had a rifle that wasn't worth a shit. Because we had equipment that wasn't worth a goddamn, wasn't nearly as good as the equipment the North Vietnamese Army had. I hate them because they shit on us when we came home. I'll never trust them again because they lied to me too many times.
You have to do that again?
Yeah. And I reckon I'll hate them for a long time. My unit had the 3rd Marine Division kill record and body count for confirmed North Vietnamese Army kills. We got a presidential unit citation for that. That also gave us the NVA kill record for Vietnam for the spring and summer of 67. Hanoi Hannah on Radio Hanoi had called us walking death because we killed so many people, which we didn't limit it to North Vietnamese. We didn't limit it by age or sex either. We were operating almost exclusively in free fire zones where anything that breathed, whether it was non-human or human, regardless of age or sex, was to be killed. And we did our job. We didn't take any prisoners. It was just understood that a prisoner of war was somebody that lived in a prisoner of war camp. Anybody that Delta 19 captured was one sorry fucker. That's just what you called them. This is one sorry fucker. And you weren't killing prisoners if they never made it to a camp. You were just killing one sorry fucker. When I joined 19, we were told that in the orientation, a sergeant came out and said, while serving with Delta Company, 1st Battalion of the 9th Marine Regiment, 3rd Marine Division, you will not shave, shower, or take prisoners in the field. And I said, hot fuck, I'm with a badass unit at last. And this is what I thought it was all about. Close with the enemy and destroy. No bullshit around. But the North Vietnamese decided that 19 should be made an example of. And they attached a regiment to wipe out the battalion. We then started taking a tremendous amount of casualties because of the amount of contact we were having. We were closing with the enemy constantly, and the enemy was closing with us. And so we were starting to be called the Walking Dead by other members of the 3rd Marine Division. The battalion was also called the Purple Heart Battalion. And my company was called Dying Delta. Consequently, I watched most of my friends be killed or crippled. I was a senior survivor in my company when I had 10 months in country and I'd only been wounded twice. My main job was walking point.
Ooh.
That was the main thing I did. And I was good.
You had to be.
That's why when I didn't want to do it anymore, I had to keep doing it. But we had a lot of... Hell's Angels adopted my unit. And I think it was June of 67. A guy came back off an emergency leave, one of our machine gun team leaders. I wasn't working on machine guns anymore. But he came back and he had the article, and he was talking about it. Hell's Angels had adopted us, and in the reason that they told the press that they adopted us was, which later this became one of our battalion mottos, and that was they adopted 1st Battalion, 9th Marines, because anybody that kills women and kids can't be all bad.
So much for the Hell's Angels.
Yeah. Joined VVAW in 1970 because by 1970 I couldn't lie to myself anymore and convince myself it meant anything. I had to admit three things to myself. That's why it took me so long. I'd been a closet, not pacifist, but a closet anti-war person, you know, for quite a while, but nobody knew because I wasn't about to tell anybody. Because I felt like I had to protect my partners that were overseas, and that meant any grunt, any guy in the infantry that was out there facing death, then by God, I had to protect him in a way that I, the only way I knew was to, you know, to try to make it mean something by telling people it did. It's kind of like going through the motions and hoping the motions will create the meaning. It's like a gangbang or some shit, you know. But finally, I realized that there's nothing I could do to create the meaning. It just, if it wasn't there, it wasn't there.
You said there were three things you had to convince yourself of.
Yeah. The first, I had to admit to myself that I had killed people for nothing. Where I came from, I was raised to believe that one day, son, you might have to go out and take the life of another human being. Just understand that if you have to do it, then, well, that's the way it is. But if you kill for nothing, that's murder. And there ain't never no call for that. And I had to admit that I'd been put into the situation where I was killing for no good reason. And I could hardly claim self-defense since I traveled 13,000 miles, jumped into that man's house. And when he defended himself and his house and his country from me, I killed him and then screamed self-defense, and it just didn't ring true. The other thing I had to admit was that I had been crippled at 19 for nothing. And when I took off my clothes and looked at myself, and remembered all the things I'd wanted to do and was now unable to do, it hurt me very much to think that it was all for some political, practical joke, that I was the butt of. And the hardest thing was to admit that my friends had died for nothing. The people that I loved more than anybody else in the world died for nothing. Including two very close friends who died trying to carry me out when I was shot. And it was all for nothing. So, it shook people up when I finally came out against the war because they hadn't seen the gestation period, you know, they didn't realize that it had been burning in me for years.
Just because you flipped your car.
Sure. And they couldn't understand why I was so bitter, because I was very bitter.
Were?
Yeah, I still am. So I joined the VVAW, because every time I tried to get around somebody in the peace movement, they pissed me off. Because they had no fucking idea what they were talking about. And I got tired of being treated like a rotten son of a bitch just because that I stood up for what I believed in. I couldn't help it if they were wrong and I had been fucked around. I shouldn't be blamed for that. No GI should be blamed for going to NAR. Because it was probably the most innocent moment in our lives. Because we trusted totally. Now, I don't understand these cats that say that they thought the war sucked and they went anyway. I don't understand that, and I don't agree with it. And I have a great deal of trouble in talking to people like that, that went when they said they knew it was wrong. Because that seems like a cowardly thing to me. I don't care how brave they were on the field. Tim O'Brien is a perfect example. In fact, he brings it out in his book, If I Died in a Combat Zone. Mm-hmm. But those that went without a question, were the essence of innocence is trust. And we said, gosh, if you need us, we'll go. Fuck, well, there were tremendous numbers of volunteers.
Mm-hmm.
Marine Corps was all volunteers, for Christ's sake. And they did draft a few thousand people. Not enough to make any significant difference on the Corps. But everybody wanted to go to Nam. We wanted to serve our country. Our daddy, our fathers had. You know, our uncles had. All of the family friends had. And we wanted our opportunity. And plus, it was a liberal crusade in the early 60s.
Mm-hmm.
It was a war that was really... The policies that got us there were basically liberal policies, and it was a noble crusade. And the peace movement, most of the people in the peace movement just made me real unhappy and uncomfortable. They were naive to a fault, moralistic, and just overcome with a superiority complex because they were so moral. And they disgusted me. And then I found out about a group of veterans that were organizing against the war as veterans. And I said, there it is. Do you remember the objectives of the VAW, the things you had to agree to?
Do I remember the objectives?
Yeah. Well, see, it took me about 3 weeks, myself and another guy whose name I won't mention because of the reason we were worried. It took us 3 weeks of just sitting there, constant hammering on our heads, should we sign this? Should we join? Because of the things on war crimes. There's an objective that said we take full responsibility for any actions that we committed or witnessed without trying to stop. I can't remember the exact wording. That were, in fact, against the rules of war. And I was afraid to. Because they just fried Lieutenant Calley, and the trial of Lieutenant Calley is one of the things that got me, finally made me stand up and say that this is bullshit. Because I'd been in Nam before Calley was, and that shit was standard operating procedure when I was there. On a search and destroy mission, in a free fire zone, you kill every fucking thing that gets in your way. And that wasn't something a corporal or a lieutenant made up, or even a captain or a major. That came all the way down the pike. Shit rolls downhill, we were the ones that caught it, and we pushed it the last a few meters down on top of the Vietnamese. So I was afraid because I thought that if I admitted to too much, that they would come and get me. Because I did in fact violate a number of things that had to do with the code of conduct, I guess, the rules of land warfare and the Hague Convention. Things that I did personally and things that I didn't stop, that I witnessed. And witnessed and witnessed as a active bystander. Sort of the cheering section. I liked VVAW immediately. I like the people I met at Dewey Canyon because most of them were combat marines and paratroopers. I met very few POGs.
Very few what?
POGs. A POG is a Marine Corps term for Rudy in the rear with the gear. Or, you know, the Army has a better term. It's RIMP, rear echelon motherfucker. But in the Marine Corps, they were called POGs. The worst thing in the Marine Corps you can be is a POG. Because the Marine Corps is built around the rifleman, the 0300, the 0311. The Marine Corps is the bayonet, the spirit of the bayonet. And everybody in the Marine Corps directly supports the rifleman. You know? Mm. And all through boot camp, we were being told you're not a real Marine unless you're a rifleman, a grunt. And that's, you know, I was never the kind, my family didn't raise me to be the kind that supported anything. And my family, if you believed in something, you did it. You didn't support it. So infantry, you know, I had to go infantry. It was the only thing I could go and still look at myself with any self-respect. I didn't tell them I'd been playing a musical instrument even for a living when I enlisted. I'd been playing musical instruments since I guess I was in third grade, fourth grade, something like that.
I didn't know that.
Sure.
What were you playing?
I played tenor, alto, and baritone sax, clarinet. And I played in it. I was in a rhythm and blues band when I joined the Marine Corps. I was making money at it. That's how I bought my first motorcycle. I didn't tell them I played an instrument. They had you go in and take a typing test. I went in there and just blasted all the keys. Came out with total gibberish. I didn't want to know why. And I went into the VVAW with the same feelings.
What do you mean?
I mean that I went in not to support, but to do. And when I committed myself to the VVAW, I committed myself totally. The same as when I enlisted in the Marine Corps. I was willing to take any risk and suffer anything to help that organization bring the case to the American people. Because then I realized that the best, my feelings were when I enlisted, I could give a shit what happened to the Gooks. And I felt, did I say when I enlisted? Mm-hmm. I meant when I joined the VVAW, which is the same thing. I was in enlisted 3 fucking years. But when I joined the VVAW, I didn't give a shit what happened to the Gooks. I didn't like Gooks, you know? I just didn't like them. And all I was concerned about was getting GIs on. Because I'd reached the point to where I realized the only way to help that 18, 19-year-old grunt was to get him the fuck home. You know? So, I went into it feeling like, you know, I'd give it 100%. Because a grunt deserves 100%. Without 100%, a grunt dies. And I knew what that was. I knew what that was all about. And I knew what it was like to be near death. A million times, when I thought I was going to die, because there was no way I could survive that firefight or that shelling or whatever. And then the big time when everybody knew I was going to die and I was shot. So I'd lived with the reality. With the reality, and then I'd lived the reality. See what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
And VVAW taught me, made me much more conscious of the Vietnamese as human beings. It was in VVAW where I learned to relate to the Vietnamese as people and love them and admire them. Before, I'd only admired the North Vietnamese Army because they were brave, tenacious, cold, but totally dedicated. They were the fucking A-right. And they'd have made good Marines. You know, so that was the compliment we used to give the NVA. A cocksucker, you know. You'd sit there and you'd find a wounded gook and you'd be looking at him and then time would come and you'd have to blow the motherfucker away. And then you'd shoot the son of a bitch and you'd look around and you'd say, little bastard would have made a good Marine. Because he stayed, he played his string out to the end, you know, the way we've been taught. That's why you don't see too many Marine prisoners of war.
I hadn't thought about it.
We didn't get took. You know, we just didn't get took. Plus, the NVA weren't taking very many enlisted Marines anyway. They were very brutal. It was like the chicken and the egg. I don't know which came first. I don't know if the NVA started fucking up wounded and dead Marines first, or whether we started fucking up wounded and dead Gooks. Because it was our policy to cut off their left ear. If you killed them. The only war in ear if you killed the son of a bitch, at least in my unit. Because that was the sign of a confirmed kill. And if you were a gunfighter, a man who killed somebody, you had to have, to get it confirmed, you had to have a witness and the body and the weapon. Otherwise, it was a probable. You know, a lot of us could rack up a shitload of probables, 24,000 probable kills, you know, because every time you squeeze the trigger, oh, I'm sure I hit that son of a bitch. I mean, we were Marines, we weren't about to admit we missed. But to get a confirmed kill, you had to have it. And had to have somebody right there, and if you killed him, he belonged to you. and anything on him, just like this fucking buckle and the whole works. Anything on him was yours except paperwork. Any papers had to go into intelligence. His military equipment was yours. His body was yours. If you wanted to carve D19 in his chest or in his forehead with a K-bar, you could do it. If you wanted to leave a ace of spades nailed in his forehead, you did it. We did that a lot.
Why?
Ace of spades was the sign of death.
No, I know that, but why market like that?
Fuck with their heads. Psychops, psychological warfare. We were told that if you cut the ear off of Dave and his other partners found him, that they believe, being Buddhist, I don't know if this is true, I've since come to believe that it's pretty much crock shit, but we'd mutilate bodies because we were told that they'd go in between heaven and hell for eternity searching for their missing partner. So we mutilate them. We left calling cards that had, we had them, for a while we had them in Vietnamese that said, you know, you've been killed by Delta, by the Walking Death, Delta Company, 1st Battalion, 19th Regiment. And then had this ace of spades with a skull and crossbones in it.
Yeah, I used to have them.
And then we had them in English that said the same thing. The one that said, for the J-O-B, because if you're going to do a job on somebody, doing the job on somebody meant fucking them up. And if you were really going to do the job, then you did the J-O-B, you know, capital letters, and you spelled it out. Well, we even had cards that had, for the J-O-B, called Walking Death, you know, and we stick them in the wounds and nail them on.
That's right.
Well, the Gooks had it figured out, too, see, because they figured that Americans were, number one, very sensitive about their testicles, about sex organs, and number two, very sensitive about funerals, because we went to the trouble of sending someone 13,000 miles back even dead. So they went into a thing where they would cut off the balls of people and put them in their mouth. And when they had wiped out Bravo Company and my unit on Operation Buffalo, in about 2 hours they killed over 100 Marines. It took us 7 days of fighting to get their bodies back. We didn't even need bodies back. We fought for our dead, which is why I'm alive. Because you, the thought of leaving a wounded Marine, I mean, you didn't even think about it. It wasn't something to consider. The thought of leaving a dead Marine was like putting your mother for sale. It was repugnant. And you'd never do it. And we fought for 7 days just to get the bodies back. It was July 2nd through the 9th, 1967, just south of the DMZ, northeast of Cantien. And the temperatures were up to 140 degrees. And we found our people, because when you'd walk up, and the flies would come up off the bodies, just a big black cloud of flies. And then you'd know you'd found one. And you'd say, hey, I found somebody. Sometimes they were so fucked up you had to look at their equipment to see if they were Marines or MBA, because we killed over 1,000 North Vietnamese in that operation. But the Gooks shot every Marine in the face, whether he was dead or alive, they shot him in the face, trying to blow their face out. Because they thought that it would undermine our morale to think of a closed casket funeral. Right? Psychops, I mean. So we were cutting off ears and nailing things to foreheads, and they were blowing faces away and cutting off nuts. Nobody realized, nobody thinking that, well, shit, they're doing it to our people and it pisses me off. I can't wait to get my hands on another Gook. Right? So the Gooks were wrong. But we didn't stop to think that when that Gook found one of his buddies with his ear cut off and his body carved up and a fucking card nailed to his head, but he was pissed off, and he couldn't wait till he got his hands on another fucking Marine.
So you were wrong too?
Oh, sure. I mean, it was all so fucking wrong, you know, which is crazy. But this, it was the ball game, you know, it was the game that we were playing. And they weren't taking prisoners, we weren't taking prisoners. They were fucking up dead people, we were fucking up dead people. They were torturing, we were torturing.
I really bought any destroyers that made the Vietnamese, it was really white.
I hated it. That's why I couldn't get next to the peace movement, because I'd seen those motherfuckers. I'd seen what they'd done to my partners, you know? The other night, last week, I took this rifle that I had sent home from Vietnam in to show this guy that runs a gun shop in Lawrence, because he'd been in Vietnam for 3 years, and he was just flabbergasted because it was a K-44, and it was in real fine condition. And very seldom would you find K-44s in good condition. And he was looking at it, and this Oriental guy came in. I didn't pay him no mind. He wanted to buy a weapon, and he didn't know what kind. He spoke real bad English. And he asked what kind of a rifle it was I had. And I didn't say anything because I wasn't talking to him. And the other guy, the guy that ran the shop, said, well, that's a Chinese communist rifle that was used by the North Vietnamese Army. He said, oh, I'm from Vietnam. And both of our heads just went, bam, you know, we just turned around and just that quick we were looking at it. Oh, I'm sorry, Claus, I didn't scare you, son.
He's okay.
And my first reaction was, give me some more ammo, you know. I mean, my first reaction without thinking was real negative, because this was a gook. I mean, any other Oriental I don't think would think like that, but he was Vietnamese. You know, he has exclusive rights to my gook feelings. And then I had to stop and think for a second. And I realized, God, I ain't got nothing against this guy. But even though I've got these lofty aspirations and these moral feelings about how I'm not angry with the North Vietnamese, I'd love to meet the men I fought against and just sit down with them, even if we couldn't talk, just to take his hand in mine and say, I'm glad you made it. But still, my gut level reaction is, kill the son of a bitch. Yeah. And I wish it wasn't like that. And it's not like that just because I don't like Vietnamese. It's like that because
it was drummed into
me. It was drummed into me, and plus, I saw them at their worst. While I was at my worst. You know? So I wouldn't blame them if they said to me, you rotten cocksucker, and ask for more ammo, you know?
Yeah, unless you'd like the idea of you sitting down and shaking hands rather than...
Well, you know, when I had dinner with Madame Ben, that was pretty hardcore on me. It was very hard. When I went to Europe in 1973, February, just before the trial, I was down at the Defense House in Gainesville. I was doing some speaking for them. I later found out that they asked me to come down because they thought I'd be a good buffer. They were having a lot of arguments, and they all decided that they trusted my judgment. It's really, I was very honored. And that they thought if I came down, arguments could be settled by my decisions. Which I don't believe that was true. But
boy, that's setting you up to be a pigeon for everybody.
Yeah, well, I was fortunate because people usually thought that I thought things out pretty well. I weighed both sides of the story.
Well, I know at steering committee meetings, I know I listened harder when you were talking than I listened to most other people. I don't know about other folks.
But anyway, they sent me to Europe. The national office sent myself and Ed D'Amato. I love Ed D'Amato. It's so hard for me to see him as a Marxist, but I love him.
Yeah, me and Brian.
Well, Marla Watson, I got her in BBW. She was from Lawrence. She hadn't been involved in anything until I met her. But they sent us over there to be at the National Amnesty Conference in Paris, which was in February, and then to the International Stockholm Conference on the War, which was being held in Rome. And while I was in Paris, we had a meeting at the PRG Embassy, and I had dinner with Madame Ben. And talked to her and some of the people here at the embassy, including Levon Sal, who apologized to me for being shot.
He apologized for being shot?
He apologized to me.
Oh, but...
For me being shot.
Wow.
No shit. And I cried. And I told him not to apologize because I was trying to kill the man that shot me. He said, still, please forgive us for those bullets? And I said, no, you've got to forgive me for mine.
That's a man you could learn a lot from.
Say again?
That's a man you could learn a lot from.
Fucking aliens. We were scheduled. I had been chosen at the Houston meeting is where we made the decision. Who would go to Hanoi. We were going to send a group of veterans over. And one of the ideas, if you remember, was to trade us for some POWs, which made for some heavy decision-making on the part of those of us who, you know, decided we would be willing to go if we were voted in. And Scott Camille was one of the people.
Marty too?
Yep. Who was willing to trade his freedom for that of a prisoner of war.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't mind telling you that I was real scared. I didn't know if I could do it. I mean, I knew I was going to do it, but I didn't, you know, it was just hard for me to do. I really don't think that Scott thought anything about it. He just thought that this should be done, and he did it. Scott is one of the most incredible people I've ever known in my life.
I must admit, I do not understand Scott.
He's just one of the bravest people I've ever known. And he has an incredible sense of loyalty. If you're a friend of Scott Camille's, you don't have to worry about anything. As long as Scott's there, he'll cover you. He's one of the people that I know that would never run out on. He's very opinionated. It's very hard for people to understand how strongly he feels about things. But when it came down to this war, he saw a lot more of the war than I did. Probably did a lot more than I did. And he had every reason to be bitter. All of us had every reason to be deadly bitter. But we weren't. But Scott is one of the... He did a great deal for the BVAW. BVAW didn't like him because he didn't take shit from the national office. He didn't believe that all power flows down. He believed that it flowed up. Or if it flowed down, national was at the bottom.
Yeah, but he did set up a private fiefdom in Florida.
Some of the best and most dedicated BVAW members I met were Florida, Georgia, Alabama, which was his region.
That's true.
And I didn't meet too many people that were just, you know, yes boys. Most of us being just out of the surface, weren't about to follow too many orders. There was...
That was a big problem with BVAW.
Fucking
A-right. Excuse me, go ahead.
Well, I heard a lot of that since I was trusted by people from all over the country. And by the national office, because they knew I did my best to always represent them to my membership. And I had the Great Plains region, which was, I think, 5 states. Four and a half. I can't remember. It was a lot of traveling. I would hear from them, and I'd hear the stories about Scott's got his own little kingdom down. But I was also down there, and I worked with Scott, and I worked away from Scott because I'd been speaking to him. And I didn't meet veterans down there that were the kind that like to be characterized as belonging to someone's little group. These were people that were, now there were policy differences between especially Tallahassee and between the rest of Florida. Tallahassee had the ear of the national office. And when Tallahassee talked to the national office listened because Tallahassee was willing to talk to him more than Scott was. They said something to Scott, he's got to tell him to get fucked. And that was it. So there ain't nothing to talk about. My membership thinks you suck ass. And one chapter in Tallahassee wasn't enough to change the policies for the state.
That explains it all.
That's the way I saw it.
Yeah.
I liked the people in Tallahassee, and I could understand where they were coming from, but they weren't the Florida membership, but the Tallahassee membership.
No, but, and that's where Scott had his problems.
God damn right. Well, it's starting to get to me. Fucker's still going there.
Okay, let's. Oh, there's so much I can ask you about. Ooh, how to narrow it down. How to pick out the important things.
Tell you one thing, Billy Lehmer. I met Billy Lehmer at the Kansas City steering meeting. October was it, or November 1971?
November.
Billy Lehmer, I didn't trust from the minute I met him. I told people I didn't trust him. I didn't think he was a cop because he was so fucked up. I didn't realize then that they literally recruited psychological wastelands, right? Because they could manipulate him. I thought that they were professional because I really didn't know that much about informers and anything. I thought, perhaps not, I don't know. But I just thought that they were agents, you know, and I didn't realize that an informer was just Joe Shit the fucking rag man out to make some money and to feel powerful. Bill Lehmer talked about more weird shit than anybody else there. And Scotty and I ran together, you know. And I didn't hear too much that I considered off the wall out of Scotty. And there was a lot of... Anything that Scotty said made sense, and he made sure that it made sense. Because he's a very... He's very, very practical. And whether or not you agree with what he's talking about, he always knows what he's talking about. Because he's a perfectionist. And even if I disagreed with him, Scotty never just threw anything at him. Billy Boy Lehmer, I thought was the biggest asshole I'd met. And I told people that were in my region, I said, watch this motherfucker. I said, this guy's full of shit. He was talking about killing people's 10 ways to Sunday. He had all different kinds of plans for blowing shit up, shooting people, and he was really into crossbows. And I thought this motherfucker was just fucking wacko. We didn't have PVS yet. You know, we hadn't discovered the post-Vietnam syndrome. So everybody just considered him an asshole. You know? And in fact, I think Johnny Upton, I was Kansas State coordinator then. Upton, who is another fine man.
I liked him.
He's top of the mark. I would have followed him anyway. He quit VVAW because it was just too fucking weird for him after a while. And it's another thing because he wasn't a negotiator. I mean, Johnny believed. And that's why I think he and Scott got along. They were both believers, and they didn't take any bullshit. But, it's just... Lehmer was just full of shit, you know? I mean, he was just full of shit. And we were into so much weird shit then with the closed meetings. And Al Hubbard just fell all the shit. The confrontation between Mike Oliver, Al Hubbard, and John Kerry. And VAW had this feeling where they didn't want to like John Kerry. He was too clean.
Mm-hmm.
He was too articulate. But that motherfucker paid his dues in the bush. And as far as I was concerned, anybody that paid those kind of fucking dues earned my respect from now until go to hell day.
He's another one who didn't expect to come in.
Well, I guess not. I mean, he had two or three hearts. Silver Star, Bronze Star with a V, Navy Com with a Combat V. You don't get that shit handed to you on a platter unless you're in the Army or the Air Force. But,
he was in the Navy, wasn't he?
Yeah, PBRs.
Yeah. Which what?
PBR, Patrol Boat River, which is Patrol River Boats. Very dangerous shit. I had a friend that was a machine gunner on one of those. He was very lucky to get home. He had a tremendous casualty rate. But there was a big confrontation between John and Al Hubbard and Mike Oliver jumping to Al's defense and Al sniveling out of it. I mean, just fucking using the stupidest excuse. It was a closed meeting, so not everybody got to watch Al use a stupid excuse to get out of it. And I was very hurt because I loved Al a lot and I trusted him. I still love him, but I don't trust him anymore. But I offered the compromise... What do we call those things? Resolution or whatever. What do we call those things? Motion. The compromise motion that stopped the argument. I was the one that offered it. Because I just thought we had to get down to business and I didn't want to see it being played out the way it was. And now I think maybe I shouldn't have. Later on at the Milwaukee meeting, it was Mike Oliver and Al Hubbard at each other's throats rather than defending each other.
Al wasn't even there.
No. And I'm the one that offered the solution, the resolution that said, we don't talk if he's not here. We don't condemn him anymore. We don't talk about it if he's not here to talk. People said, right on. Brother Musgrave's got it down. Then we called National, talked to Al, and Al said it was okay to talk about it. So then I had some fucking questions that I wanted to know the answers to. And I brought it up, but we just blew it off because by then we didn't want to, it was too controversial. We didn't want to deal with it anymore.
You're talking about Milwaukee?
Yes.
Yeah.
And we had enough going on in Milwaukee because...
What did happen? Oh, excuse
well,
me.
Well, the indictments had just come down.
Yeah.
And so that was the main thing on everybody's mind. It was just pretty fucked in the butt in Milwaukee.
Yeah, that was... I remember that. What did happen in the closed meeting?
In the closed meeting?
Going back to Kansas City.
Wow. In reference to, give me some leaders. I mean, that was, how many closed meetings did we have?
Well, there was that big one that afternoon.
That was the fight between John and Al.
Yeah, but didn't, some other stuff went down. Because there were, you know, because when we were finally allowed back in, you know, we were told these things about the you know, five separate actions and, you know, burning Christmas trees and this.
Oh, the Christmas action.
Yeah, and so other stuff had gone down. I mean, because Al collapsed about halfway through that closed meeting.
Al did not collapse.
Well, that's the story we got.
Well, I know that's the story you got, and that's one of the things I mentioned to you about your manuscript, because it's not what happened.
Well, tell me what happened.
There's still tape going.
Yeah.
Al did not collapse. Al was on the spot. John wanted to know just what he had done in Vietnam. And number one, John wanted to know, have you been to Vietnam? Were you serving in Vietnam, not just on a layover? And just what the fuck did you do in Vietnam? Because Al, even though Al admitted that he had lied on the television program, that he wasn't an officer, still was saying that he was disabled in a plane crash while checking out another pilot, which is impossible because he wasn't fucking a pilot. John said, listen, I'm going on television and before groups all over the country, and they're continually putting me on the spot about you, because they were on that program together, if I remember correctly.
Yeah, they were.
And he said, all I want to know is, if I'm taking the heat for you, I want to be able to tell you. And it wasn't an outlandish request. Al tried to get out of it every which way. Mike jumped up. They both got real violent about it. You're fucking with the integrity of our brother, doo-dah, doo-dah, on and on. It was very obvious to me they were avoiding dealing with the issue. Then Al suddenly had an ulcer attack. I've got to get back to my doctor in New York. And we said, listen, there are doctors here that can take care of you. No sweat. No, I want to see my own doctor. So he was going to take, say, 4 or 5 hours to find a doctor in this immense, tremendous, critical need and in this pain, when he could have had a doctor in 30 minutes, an hour. The doctor in New York wasn't at the steering committee meeting in Kansas City, and that's exactly where he left. He did not collapse, and it was such an obvious ploy as to be there was a lot of cynical comments made about it from people that were present for the rest of the steering committee meeting, and it shadowed over my feelings about Al. Well, it still does. He didn't collapse in that meeting. He was avoiding facing the fact that he had lied on national TV and that I don't think he was in Vietnam. Because I told my solution was, let's give Al time to present to the membership either through the national office in a letter or the newspaper or through the next National Steering Committee meeting, proof of his service in Vietnam. Everybody said, fine, that sounds fair. We don't expect everybody to carry their service record with them.
Mm-hmm.
Never. It never happened. We never found out. And Al sniveled at him. John was right. Al was wrong. Al came out being righter than John, because he was black, because people didn't want to confront him, because it was racist to confront him. And John was wrong, because he was rich. His initials were JFK. He looked like a Kennedy.
and he could speak better English than anyone else.
Better English than most of the Kennedys, too.
John suffered from the fact that he was just too goddamn clean.
Yeah.
People forgot that John had been wounded, and people forgot that John had been decorated for valor, and John never made an issue out of it. That's one thing he never did. When he gave his speeches, and I was present because I did speaking gigs with him, he always wore a suit. He didn't wear his ribbons except one time. You know where that was? Senate Foreign Relations Committee meeting in Washington, D.C.
June D.C. 3.
That's right.
Yeah.
I was present for that. And he